see as each day and week of the past goes by, more computers appear on this table. That reflects the greater knowledge that we're all gaining about the technology as we go. You're still stuck with my low-tech slides. Just to buy them a little bit more time as we try to set it up. First, I don't know if I want to make an announcement. We have a mentors program, not a mentors program, a mentors program. And why don't we be the first to try the new United Nations microphone system?
I love the color.
Are you a color too? Why is everyone a color?
If you get color, if you push the button to turn on your mic, you should turn on your mic only if you have something you want to share. I know people sort of testing them out now, like fireflies in the night.
You
dropped the red ring.
What I have to share is the mentor program. We have 12 practitioners who agree to, they're actually taking the course in virtual experience. And they agree to advise students on their course papers. Specifically, they'll help you pick a topic and they'll review a draft. So we have them all listed with little bios on a web page, which is.
It's up there somewhere. Right?
cyber.law.harvard.edu/clinical/mentors.html. So you can look them over. If you're interested in partnering with one of the mentors, please email me. And if my email is not there, I'll put it up tonight. And give me your first, second, and third choices of who you'd like to mentor with. You want to try it?
Yeah, we're trying to get there. Apparently, the net is as slow as it's ever been before. This may actually be our fault. We just sent an email to 15,000 HLS alumni. So somehow, it may actually be our concern's fault that there's no internet today. Either that or there's been a cyber attack. Okay, is there anything else we're going to the demo, Ben, or should I just start? So Ben's going to try to convince the net to go back up so we can try all the various toys we promised you. You should try to get your own computer hooked up to the Ethernet if that's what you're looking for. You probably have great experience with this from playing Hearts and other classes. We use it for other purposes here. But in the meantime, why don't we get started on today? By the end of class, I will trip on any of this. Okay. So, here's what I was hoping to do today. One, look at the new tech, and in this case, make fun of it. Two, understand what open code is. And third, figure out whether it matters, and if so, to whom and why. If we could leave class today having addressed each of these issues, I would deem it a success. Here's a list of mentors. Thank you very much. The list of mentors up there on various web pages. It's an experimental program you should take advantage of. It's actually a chance to connect to practice. At least for some papers, which may be practice-oriented about particular doctrinal questions, you'll find the mentors particularly helpful. Okay, so why don't we start with what open code is? Is it worth it? If we have good enough net, Ben, to alert people how to do remote comment system?
It's getting better.
It's getting better. So is there a URL we should send people to? So if you go to cyber.law.harvard.edu/is2000/ask, A-S-K, that's it, /ask. You should see a special screen appear. Let me just see if it's happening for any of you. There's people doing email. There's somebody doing Windows Update. Risky proposition. There's somebody, command.com, the HTTP server, digital music abstract, there's a Palm Pilot.
God, you learn a lot in the back of the room.
This is like, I just know how I'm doing. I just wander in the back and see how many people are fussing around. Okay, so has anybody successfully gotten to the Ask page that I just described? Yes, you have. So, tell me what you see. Use your Google mic. Press your magic button.
I see a questions and comments submission form that says useful and below the real-time comments to the PAs. All messages will be posted to the website in the IS 2000 site.
So,
boxes your first name, last name.
So, wonderful. So this thing is working. Go to that Ask page, and I don't know, Ben, can you put up a copy of this on the big screen so that those who are computer deprived and seething right now with the digital divide can see see what they're missing. Okay, there's the question submission system. You punch in your info here and type in your question. And this way, it's not a substitute for raising your hand. You can still feel free to raise your hand. But this is another way to frame your question or comment. Click submit. And there may be a moment the TAs or I will take a look at what is coming in. It'll actually affect the path of the class in real time. You may even find your comment thrown up on the big screen at an opportune moment. This is also a nice way. I know that raising your hand is a social act. It's an act that says, I have something that's worth stopping the class to say. And some people don't like making that statement that might be implied, even if they actually have something useful to say. This is a way of saying it, and then you can leave it up to the gods of technology, chance, or the TAs to decide whether or not it actually works its way onto the floor of the class. So I encourage you all to try it. If you're sitting next to somebody with a computer and you don't have one, you should steal the computer away and type your own question if you are feeling so inclined. Okay, if there are any questions on how to use the question system, please submit them through the question system and we'll answer them as the class progresses. Okay, so let's move on. That was the demo of the new tech, and Ben, you're going to keep an eye too on whether any new comments are coming in. All right, so let's take care of the first thing. What is code? What is code? Now, many of you probably think you know what code is. You probably do. I don't mean to say that you don't. But it's actually worth dwelling upon in a sort of Zen-like way at this point in the course. What is code exactly? By code, I mean something roughly synonymous with software, or with, I guess you call them, a set of instructions destined to be processed by something. So if you look at it that way, you might be coding your Mr. Coffee when you tell it that you want it to start brewing at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. And there's at least a little bit of software in that clock such that you can set the time, and when 6 o'clock rolls around, it knows to start dispensing stale water through the filter and giving you your morning coffee. So in computer parlance, we think of code as a series of instructions given to the computer asking it to do something. And there are two flavors of code, at least. In common parlance, there is source code and so-called object code. And if you actually looked at Lessig's piece, you'll see that you can slice the salami as thin as you want. But to put it roughly, there's the code that programmers write and other programmers look at, and if they know that particular computer language, get a sense for what it does. And often, even if they don't know that particular computer language, you get a sense for what it does. And then there's the code that actually ends up feeding into the computer for the computer to look at. And just to give you a sense, then, of how that works, we're also going to talk about what's open, but I'll just cut to this chase. Remember this chart that I gave you of how something wends its way through the internet. Where did the little pointer thing go? I don't know if this dot is helpful. But right, you have the data packet go into the internet cloud, to the internet service provider, and to a destination from a source. So it may be useful to actually zoom in on a source and see just what goes inside this circle. We're about to zoom in. That's a very crude magnifying glass, that red square, and see what there is to see. And here's what there is. I just have to be near enough for the computer to convince it to do it. All right, so there's a zoom up of that circle. There's the data about to come out of it. And there's a chip. All right, so somewhere inside that circle is a computer chip. And what is a computer chip? It just has these little pins that go in and out of it. And all it is something that says, if the pins get electrified one way, the pins on the other side get electrified another, but roughly. So a typical thing you might ask a chip like this to do is give an electrical signal that says, 1, 3, add, and see if 4 comes out the other side. Then you've got a very useful chip performing mathematics for you at this level. Chips are typically, although increasingly less so, they're typically only good for such low-level operations. They're going to add stuff, they're going to divide stuff, and you might ask for a given chipset, what are the instructions? What does that chip know how to do? Now, the problem is that it's so finely grained, the kinds of things you ask a chip to do, is at such a low level. If you're trying to get something complicated to happen, like, you know, a happy icon is supposed to appear and say, welcome to you on your screen, It may be quite a lot of code having to go into this chip to make it happen. So what happens is, we don't just have a chip inside a computer and instructions written directly for the chip. Instead, you get certain layers. So here's a layer known as the basic input-output system, the BIOS. Now, there's nothing sort of magical about this term. What exactly belongs inside a BIOS may be a matter of orthodoxy for some computer scientists, but it's certainly not a matter of orthodoxy for a computer manufacturer. I have one sample task that the BIOS of a computer typically does, and that is manage the clock. Somewhere also under the hood of most computers, there's a clock of some kind. It knows what time it is, and how many seconds it'll last since what time it was. And the BIOS is the one that runs interference, that talks to the clock, knows how to relate to the clock, and at some point, something can ask the BIOS instead of the chip, tell me what time it is, and the BIOS can tell you. Very basic functions shoehorned inside the basic input-output system. Okay, then sitting on top of that, you have something like an operating system. An operating system are a set of instructions that know how to talk to the BIOS, and in many cases know how to talk directly to the chip, but in turn, also know how to talk to things like printers. So there's a little printer off to the side connected to the operating system. Now, why bother to have an operating system? One reason is then you can have so-called applications. And what are applications? With programs, like Eudora Mail, or like Calculator, or something. And thanks to the existence of an OS, if you're a developer seeking to write an application, your life is a lot easier than it otherwise would be. It's the kind of application that would actually have a face that you can start talking on your screen. Thanks to the OS, it can just give a high-level command. It can talk to the OS and say, you know, I'd like a window to appear on the screen of this dimension. And the OS says, no problem, consider it done. And then the OS has a lot of code that figures out how to talk to the BIOS, the chip, some of the other chips in the computer, to make a little window appear on the screen and have a certain dimension to it and have certain text appear. That makes your life really easy if you write applications. The only thing is, you then have to rely on the OS existing. Once you write an application, expecting the OS to be there to run that translation for you, if you get rid of the OS, your program is only half done. And then sitting on top, between the application and the OS, just to get some terminology straight, there are these things known as APIs. An API is an application programming interface. And it's the vernacular that the application developer uses to talk to the operating system. So the operating system gets put out and says, this is how to talk to me. If you talk to me using some other set of words, or put them in some other order than the one I am giving you right now, you may get unpredictable or nonsensical results. You just have to do it this way, and if you do, I promise you that the following things will happen on the user's screen, through the user's keyboard, on the user's computer, etc., etc. So it's these interfaces, which is really just sort of like a dictionary that you can use that tells you how to translate what you want to do, I want a window to appear, into the right phraseology to pass to a given operating system so that the operating system can make that sort of thing happen. So this is an example then of lots of different kinds of software. Even the chip, I suppose, is a form of software, although it's no longer so soft. It's been burned into the chip that will follow electrical impulses and instructions this way. But if you start to realize that the impulses have some rhyme or reason to them, that when the rightmost pin heats up, it means add, suddenly you can start thinking of it as if it were software rather than as if it were hardware. And indeed, oftentimes hardware and software can be completely interchangeable. They're so-called emulators, programs that let one chip pretend to be another, or that let one computer pretend to be another, as if the chip were in there. And it's all happening just to some fleet interference run between extra emulator software and the chip below. So this may be clear as mud, but it's starting to get a sense of what code is. Again, a set of instructions that you write. You may be writing them at different levels of generality and specificity. These are so-called low-level instructions. These are typically high-level ones up here. And again, there are these two phases to code. There's the source code. And then, what often happens is the application's source code, the thing that's written in a given language, gets pumped through something called a compiler. And what comes out the other side is code that the chip is a lot easier able to handle. The only drawback is if you look directly at the object code, unless you are highly skilled, it's very difficult to tell what went into the recipe to make it happen. Think of it as a recipe. A program is a recipe that says, you know, 2 cups of this, 4 cups of that. The object code is actually executing the recipe and producing the cake. And you may or may not know what went into the cake, by looking at the object code. So questions on this much, either through the system that we've seen, Ben, or through the traditional way of raising your hand. To answer an unasked question, you have to have the air conditioning turned on. I see. All right, so as far as blaming goes, it's not our fault unless we cause the system to have any any questions on the exposition thus far? I think my whole social construction of asking questions theory just put a hole where anybody's attempting to ask questions. Yes, thank you. But light up your mic.
Can you explain the difference between source and object code before we're not done with it?
I thought I had done it.
I'm really confused.
So, Ben, show us an example of some source code. Can you do that, or are you busy doing something else?
Okay, were any of you
like forced in junior high school to take BASIC? And you had to write like print hello, go to 10. You were writing source code. That's right, you were coding. He's about to show us a script of some kind. Is that what you're doing? All right, so we have no code to show. This is like water everywhere. And not a drop. Great. All right, so if you had BASIC when you were in junior high school, 10, print hello, 20, go to 10, that's source code. That's instructions in a given vernacular. And so long as you remain consistent to the so-called syntax, you order stuff in a certain way, and to the semantics of the language, which is to say, you use the right symbols when you're supposed to, you type P-R-I-N-T when what you're intending to have happen at that point of the proceedings is for something to be printed upon the screen, you are authoring source code in a given language. And after that language happens, how do you do it? Oh, okay. Ben has given up on the source code, so you just have to imagine. After the program is so-called compiled, it is turned into a format that runs a lot faster because the words P-R-I-N-T, the letters just disappear, and instead some token, some symbol, a chart of symbols that means print, and the chip knows it means print, or the OS knows it means print, is substituted, and you don't know when it's print, so you're looking at this stuff. In fact, if you're just on a Windows machine, you could go under Start, Run, and type Command. That gets you to an old-fashioned DOS prompt. And then just cd space backslash gets the root directory, and then type type space command.com. And you'll be looking at a compiled program that is the command processor for the disk operating system written by Microsoft way back when. If that wasn't clear, don't worry about it. You're not missing too much. You'll just see a bunch of garbage on your screen that is just illustrative of the point that you won't know what it means. So, this object code, why did object code ever come about? There was a time when it wasn't really object code. It just went right into the computer and the computer processed it. But again, for efficiency reasons, for the kinds of reasons that get computer scientists very excited, there came to be these two kinds of code, source and object. Object always generated from the source, and much more understandable to a computer, and by happenstance, a lot less understandable to us. A happenstance coming from the halls of computer science departments the world over. Now here's an interesting feature of code. Start with source code. Source code is text of some kind, right? You're typing stuff, print hello, and then you hit enter. So it's written text. Is it creative? I don't know. It's at least as creative as some of the things subject to copyright. So if you follow this down the line, and at one point people did, they concluded that source code itself is subject to copyright. You can copyright source code as if it were any other literary expressive work covered by copyright. And indeed, there was some doubt about this for a while, and later treaties signed by the United States and other countries made clear, yes, that's right, computer software is covered. covered by copyright. So if you look over somebody's shoulder as he or she is writing that basic program, and you were to copy it pound for pound, you have in fact infringed copyright unless you've got some kind of excuse, like a defense, like fair use, simply by having copied the code. Now this is an interesting point, since code isn't just expressive, it's functional. It's a series of instructions that if you pour into the machine, out the other end pops results of some kind. Microsoft Word is a word processing program written in code for which the code then is subject to copyright. Object code, too, is thought to typically be subject to copyright, even though it's rare that a human hand has written it, and it's hard to see creative expression in it. You know, you could have a dog run across a blank canvas with paint on its paws and expect more creative expression in that than you would get out of object code from a computer. Nonetheless, it's subject to copyright. So what does that mean? That means that if you write a computer program, you can prevent somebody from copying it, even as you sell lots of copies yourself to somebody else. Yes, question, and how do you all find out?
If code, as you said, is considered expression of some kind, does it also make it, what are the ramifications for that under the First Amendment? Would it also be protected as a form of speech of the codebreaker?
Yeah, this is a good question, one that looks forward to some of the things we'll be talking about later in the course. For instance, there may be code that does things that are quite dangerous. Code that shows you how to hack into a nuclear power plant and make it overheat or something. Or code that encrypts stuff so that people can exchange messages over open networks. And somebody in the middle with a pair of alligator clips can have no clue what is being talked about between those two parties. Traditionally, in regulatory circles, those have been seen as very different things. Yes, it's expressive for the purposes of copyright, so we will give code copyright protection. It doesn't necessarily mean, says the government, that written expression as put into computer code is itself worthy of First Amendment protection, should it be regulated. There are a couple cases on this issue as the Commerce Department and the State Department and federal legislation have attempted to regulate code that encrypts stuff, originally as a munition, as a weapon, under the export control laws, and people have challenged that under the First Amendment. A guy named Bernstein who wanted to sit in a class like this and be a lot more technical than I've been so far and teach people how to encrypt stuff was challenging the restrictions on export because he was afraid that there were foreign grad students in the room. He could be thought of as exporting these munitions by telling them how to encrypt stuff. Doug behind the green iMac Center had a question. Oh, there you are, Doug. Your iMac blinded me.
I was wondering, how do they separate, or can you separate the object code from the functionality of the program itself? Since, I guess from my understanding, if you release the source code or something like Netscape, for example, you can look at the source code and that can be copyrighted. But unless you have a can opener of some sort, you can't really see the actual object code. It wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to a human being anyway. How do they separate the copyright for object code from any copyrights that apply to the functionality of the program itself, the interface, things like that?
Well, I think I understand your question. Let me try to rephrase it to something I know I understand, and then you can tell me when I answer it if there's any resemblance to what you're asking. Oftentimes, if you go to the store and buy some software, what you're getting on your floppy disk or on your CD-ROM when you download is object code. It's stuff not meant for your eyes, and if you look at it, it won't help your eyes very much, but it is meant to talk to your computer. Now, there is a way. If you have source code, of course, all you need to get from source code to functioning object code is a so-called compiler. And you can buy these things. They're like, you know, pants pressers. You just buy a pants presser, and you put in wrinkled pants, you press it, and out comes straight pants. Source code goes to object code. An analogy of dubious value, but those were my ideas. Going the other way is interesting. What if somebody hands you object code and you generate source code out of it? The answer is typically maybe yes. That's so-called reverse engineering or reverse compiling. And if you go ahead and reverse engineer the object code, it's in effect being able to pop up the hood of the inscrutable car engine that you're using to drive around in, and start getting a sense of, oh, I see, this must be the carburetor, this must be the oil pan, now I can see how the car manages to get such good gas mileage. Now, reverse engineering is something that if you are in the position of generating object code to sell to people, you might not want to do. Maybe you just want them to use the car and never pop the hood. That way, whatever secrets and good things you put in there remain yours forevermore. And one question has been, if somebody reverse engineers object code to source code, are they infringing copyright? And there had been a range of answers on this. One set of answers had been, yes, you are, because you are necessarily generating a copy of, if not the source code, something that really looks like it, out of the object code when you reverse engineer it, hence you have infringed copyright. Even though you never did have to see the original source code, you've managed to make a pretty good copy of it, so that infringes copyright. Others have said it may infringe copyright, but perhaps it is fair use. There's one famous case in which there had been a video game manufacturer, and somebody had devised a cute little cartridge thing that went in between the game and the cartridge that gave you extra mana. That they decompiled the code of the various cartridges and of the machine to give you extra mana. And the video game maker said, that's foul, you infringed our copyright, you've got to pay us a license, a royalty for this valuable device that you created. And in that instance, the court said, that was okay, that was actually fair use to reverse engineer it for this purpose. You'll see in the text of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, a little snippet that I gave you, I think section 1201, there is actually an exception written into it that is meant to maintain the muddy status quo, whatever it is. It says, the fact that we have a new Digital Millennium Copyright Act that prohibits all sorts of hacking, literally in this case, cracking the object code of the system for the purpose of finding out how it works, so you can steal the copyrighted content, the data that it might be guarding. It's a program to guard content. That is now illegal under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but we don't mean by that to say that if you just reverse engineer Mr. Copy, you necessarily are in trouble. We'll leave that again to the money status quo of the law. So as you can see, it's a weird set of rules around source and object code. But what it does mean is that out in the world, you can start applying a taxonomy. The words we've been loosely using are open and closed. Most of the purists on either end of the so-called open-close debate would go into conniptions of the use of such terminology. They would say it's not open and closed. If you talk to Richard Stallman, something I hope you do someday, but not in the venue of this class, Richard will give you a stern lecture if you dare to use the word open-source software. He'll say there's no such thing as open-source software. All there is free software and shackled software. Free software is not free of charge. It's not like free beer. It's free as in America is free. That's the kind of software that Richard Stallman says is out there in some instances, and that's the right labels to put on the axis that I have been calling open and closed. On one end, you have software that is liberated, and on the other end, you have software that is shackled. What does he mean by liberated and shackled? Well, to shackle it, he says, is to take the rights that you have as the creator of a given set of software and actually invoke them. Say, I will not allow copies to be made of my software without my permission. And if you want to make copies of the object code, forget it. You're going to have to come to me to buy individual copies of my code on a per software basis, perhaps. And if you want to use my source code, if you want to get into my source code somehow and improve it in some way, for example, you're going to have to talk to me. Because what are you going to be doing if you do improve my code without my permission? You're going to be making a derivative work under the copyright law, a right that is reserved exclusively to the copyright holder. So all those derivative work makers also have to come to me, and I'll think about it. Maybe I'll make it, maybe I won't, but I reserve that right. In Richard Stallman's dictionary, that is unfree software. And he says that on the other end of the spectrum, there is free software. And what is free software? But software without encumbrance. It says, one, if somebody is going to give you software to use on your computer, they better give you both the source code and the object code, not just the object code. To not give you the source code is not to tell you how it works. We have a right to know how this stuff works. And why? Because it's just a moral right. This is stuff that betters humanity. It doesn't leave your hands and you give it to somebody else. You can just make a copy. So you're under a moral imperative. He actually derives this from Kant in two sentences of his manifesto, which you may have seen. Kant says, give away your code. When he realized, I mean, this is a translation of Kant, of course, in the original German. He says, if you just put your code into the public domain, if you just make the code truly free in that way, that's a problem. Because your code is a butterfly just waiting for a butterfly net to take it in, tweak it a little bit, and thereby proprietize it. What does that mean? If you take something in the public domain and you make a derivative work from that, you're entitled to copyright that if you're adding creative value of your own to it. This was, for instance, an argument that West Publishing made when it said that it took United States law, the central public domain, we talked about that, in one end, and out the other end, put out United States law with interspersed star paging. Remember helpful star paging? That tells you on what page of the corresponding West text you can find a given chunk of the law. They say that is creative content going into our system, and as a result, if you were to copy that law with the star pages in it, you could go to jail for infringing our copyright. One court has actually tested that and been a little skeptical that it's actually creative content of star pages. West actually has a fallback argument that has yet to be tested, and that's that they correct typos. There are typos of opinions. They correct them. That adds creative content to the opinion. Thereby, they can proprietize it, and away they go. And the neat thing there is, while you might be able to write a script to take out the star paging from West's stuff and turn it back into plain old law without their creative star paging, how do you make typos appear when you didn't know where they originally were in the opinion or the law that West has provided you for which they say the typos have been fixed? So that's a good example of the United States code and the attempt to copyright it or a word derivative to it. And the lesson from that, says Richard Stallman, is if we just put it in the public domain, bad news, because derivative works will be made and those will be proprietized. And the way that this stuff links together means that what had formerly been, say, a free operating system could become a proprietized one. So let me explain a hypothetical case as to how that might happen. To do that, let's just fill in the rest of this chart. On top of your applications and APIs, you have network protocols so that out the end of the computer, out the cable that pops out the back of your computer, there goes a stream of data that the internet knows how to handle. Somehow it gets into this so-called TCP/IP form and the network knows how to handle it. How does the network know how to handle it? Trust me, Eudora doesn't know the first thing about TCP/IP. Eudora has no clue how to handle the internet. What Eudora does is it relies on the operating system. It says, I have something that should go out over the internet. Would you mind sending it for me? The operating system says, no problem. We'll take care of it. Now again, what is or isn't exactly inside an operating system isn't necessarily ordained. In the days before network-enabled operating systems, there was third-party software you could buy such that, this thing called Trumpet Winsock. So somehow you would get Trumpet Winsock from the Trumpet people. And if you installed the Trumpet thing on your machine, you could then find yourself surfing the internet with programs that knew how to talk to Trumpet. Trumpet would run interference. That was a somewhat awkward way of doing things, but it worked. Trumpet we've not heard of anymore because the later version of Windows simply took Trumpet's functionality and put it inside of the operating system, and then who needs Trumpet anymore? It's just inside the OS. Indeed, you find operating systems of some stripes growing and growing and growing, taking on functions that formerly served by applications, may now become part of the OS. And it's that process that Richard Stallman, if he had the time and energy to give a sort of screed here, would be saying is the real danger. You could write a nifty little program that does something, you set it free into the world, and before you know it, somebody like Microsoft has snapped it up, made a few changes, made it proprietary, made it incompatible with the original, and then people start using Microsoft's, and before you know it, your good work is now being sold and shackled by someone else. And thus did Richard come up with a brilliant idea in something called the General Public License, Is it possible to just throw up a copy of the GPL somewhere? There's no net at all. What's that? Do you have that? No, nobody has that.
Yeah.
Somebody has it. I have a paper copy. You have a paper copy? God. Eric Saltzman, Executive Director of the Berkman Center. Thank you very much. Well, somebody was thoughtful enough, exactly. You all should have known the GPL was in your readings. Completely hanging out to dry here. Alright, so where are the terms and conditions of the new general public license? My God. So, everyone is permitted to copy and distribute verbatim copies of this license document, but changing it is not allowed. Now, that's the license for the license. So, the license on the license document says you can copy the license freely. Don't take for granted that the license itself can be copied freely. After all, it is subject to copyright. You may copy this freely, but changing it is not allowed. Is that valid? Can he make such a claim? I don't know. If we were to put it into lawyer speak, we might say that that means the derivative work right remains reserved to the author. You are not allowed to prepare any kind of derivative work. However, you can copy and distribute it freely, thereby maintaining the integrity the license. That would be the theory, at least. And then there is a long license here, and let me just read the preamble. You may have read it, but I'll just read it right here. The licenses for most software are designed to take away your freedom to share and change it. By contrast, the GNU General Public License is intended to guarantee your freedom to share and change free software, to make sure the software is free for all its users. And it encourages you to use the license on your own programs, and basically, what it does is we protect our rights with two steps. One, we copyright the software. We assert the right we have to copyright it. And then we offer a license which gives you legal permission to copy, distribute, and or modify the software. So you're allowed to copy it freely, you're allowed to distribute it freely, you can even modify it. But if you do modify it, here's what has to happen. If you modify it, you must cause the modified files to carry prominent notices stating you changed the files and the data that it changed. You must cause any work that you distribute or publish that in whole or in part contains or is derived from the program or any part thereof to be licensed as a whole at no charge to all third parties under the terms of this license. This is a so-called viral license. The actual terms of the license require that the license itself be replicated should you make a copy or a derivative work of the program. It requires you to print a copyright notice, and you must send the source code along with the object code to the program as you do it. Now, before we actually hit our panel and start trying to figure out why any of this has anything to do with anything, let's just first see, now that we have a taxonomy, how readily we can apply it to the typical computer. So suppose this is Ben's ThinkPad right here. And there's a chip inside. The chip has an instruction set in it. That instruction set is typically subject to copyright, and it's also subject to patent because it's a useful machine. So does it seem, at least, through recent decisions. You can copyright this thing, and you can patent this thing. So if somebody were to take the chip and make another chip without getting permission from you, based on this one, having flipped up the hood and reverse engineered it, you could sue them to try to block that activity from taking place. So if you want the chip, you've got to go to somebody else. Now, in practice, Intel, which makes chips, also cross-licenses some of its patented technology so that other companies that compete with Intel, in a manner of speaking, are also allowed to produce it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they have the right to do it if Intel doesn't want them to. All right, so that's the chip level. The BIOS. It turns out the BIOS is written just by one or two companies. A personal computer, like an IBM PC, is a very small and standard set of instructions. They get their dime or their quarter for every computer that rolls out of an assembly line that uses the BIOS. And if you were to copy it, it would be subject to copyright. So that's the BIOS here. Then we get to the operating system. If you're talking Windows, this is, in Eric Raymond's words, a classic something coming out of the cathedral kind of system. This is an operating system designed in one place by a group of people organized hierarchically under a man named Bill Gates, and they work together to generate software for which the full except the copyright laws invoked to protect it. So if you create a derivative work, you figured out some way to reverse engineer Windows and make a new Windows with new features, you would be violating copyright if you didn't have permission to do it. If you copy your Windows floppy disk or do multiple installations, you could also find yourself infringing copyright by doing so. You may even find yourself infringing contracts. There might be a quick wrap agreement of some kind that says, by accepting this disk and staring at it, you are agreeing not to use it to install on multiple computers, notwithstanding any right you might have to do so under copyright. And that's the OS. Now, there are other OSes out there. For instance, there was an operating system called Unix. Unix itself was subject to copyright. But the operating system is something that talks to the BIOS and the chip in a very specific way, and through these APIs, expects a limited set of requests and demands from the applications that run on top of it. And what that means is, even if you have no way of knowing what's inside a given operating system, you can't look at the source code, suppose you don't even want to, you could start from scratch and say, I'm going to write some code that takes a particular kind of vernacular in one end, say the vernacular that's expected of Windows code, and spits a particular kind of vernacular out the other end down the chip into the BIOS. What would the result be? The result would be a module that can be swappable for the original item, in which the claim would be no copyright has been infringed, because you haven't made a copy of the object code, and you haven't used the source code. All you've done is re-engineer it from scratch. It's like staring at a car and saying, okay, it's going to have some kind of engine in front. If you press on the accelerator, it's going to go a certain speed. If you press on the brake, it's going to stop at this rate. I can do that. And you write a code to make a car that way. And so long as you haven't looked under the hood, how can anybody claim that you have copied any computer software inside that was designed to make things work a certain way? And thus, for example, in a particular programming language called Java, we had Microsoft assemble a team of engineers as pristine as a newly chosen jury. They swore up and down that they never looked at anything resembling the source code of the Java language. At which point they said, great, now write Java. And they sat there, they thought hard, they worked hard, lots of money was thrown at it. Before you know it, you had Microsoft Java come out the other end, for which Microsoft said, we have not infringed anybody's copyright, because we didn't peek at the source code and we didn't copy the object code, and now you can use our Java, which by the way is copyrighted, in place of anybody else's Java of some kind to use. Now, I've been invoking this word Java, most of you probably think this is still copy, some type of copy before. In the Microsoft day, we will sort out Java from Java. But rest assured, the point here is that there are various modules, and if you just know how things are supposed to work on the boundaries, the black box in the middle could be built and rebuilt and rebuilt. Indeed, unless there's some wrinkle with patent, and we don't know if there is or not, it is hypothetically possible to write something that could be just as good as Windows. You could turn on your computer and it would act like Windows. And you could throw in software designed to run on Windows, but the thing in the middle wouldn't be Windows. It would be a proto-Windows designed by somebody who lived under a rock for the past century but still knew how to code and could write Windows and not have looked at the original Windows. And at that point, you could start selling those like hotcakes and not owe Microsoft a dime. Now, in fact, something like this happened with Microsoft DOS. DOS was the predecessor to Windows. It's what you see when you still call up that command window I talked about on your screen. It's a lot less friendly than Windows. There isn't as much pointing. There's a lot less clicking. But it still does things like documenters and copy files and stuff like that. And it has programs that run on it that expect DOS in order to work. And in this instance, Digital Research rewrote DOS from ground up. They call it DR-DOS. Some call it Dr. DOS. And if you had DR-DOS on your computer, you'd never know the difference from just having regular old DOS on your computer. The only real difference is no money was going to Bill Gates for DR-DOS. So there's a story as to how Bill Gates ended up making sure that DR-DOS is something we've never heard of. But it doesn't have to do with a suit for copyright infringement because it was built sort of in that clean room mentality. And thus did we have Richard Stallman in the 70s say, you know what, this Unix thing is a pretty cool operating system. Let's rewrite it and substitute one plank at a time each of its features with new features that will be free. but otherwise identical to the old ones. I'm not making the myth of the ship of fools. This is the ship for which each plank of the ship was replaced one at a time. And at the end, the guy who had done this replaced every single plank in the ship, said, so, is it the same ship? And, you know, nobody knew. It's a philosophical question. I don't know, is it the same ship or not? But at the very least, we can say that every plank in it has been replaced, and it is functionally equivalent to the old ship. It may not be the same ship, but it's as good as that ship for most purposes, such as sailing the seas, presuming that the new planks are as good as the old ones. And thus, if you start substituting components here, if only you had the programming right for proprietary components. The only thing is it's really hard to do, and hence there have been very few attempts to actually duplicate Windows from scratch. But it has been done with so-called Unix. The result was something called GNU/Linux, for which every component of it is subject to a license similar to the one we were just talking about, the GNU General Public License. Okay, there's one more piece to this, but let me see if there are questions thus far. Any questions? Eric? Oh, he says, speaking of Windows, you can open the door. Okay, I'll open the door. It is like 100 degrees. But again, I changed the teaching assistant job description just slightly. Okay.
We, just very briefly, we go back to your analogy of cake.
Who's this? Sorry. This will be your problem. Yeah, there
we go. I know I'm talking one. So if you don't look at the recipe, but you make a cake that looks exactly the same, tastes exactly the same,
correct,
but you haven't looked at the recipe,
that's
you,
right,
you can...
Are you copyright infringing the recipe? You haven't copied it. You just come up with it on your own. Now, the chances of you would end up with a recipe that was exact word for word of the other one, you might add the cardamom after the brown sugar or something, rather than before. Yes, that's not going to be a copyright infringement, even though the resulting cake may taste the same as another one. And thus, you get people reverse engineering perfumes and stuff. And there's no violation of, say, trade secret there. In fact, you didn't figure out what the secret sauce was. And indeed, Jolt Cola tries to taste like Coca-Cola. And just does it through a careful process of refining sugar. Is there a question back there? Yeah. Try the button.
I just have a question.
But you try to button though, the little glowing thing.
Okay. When Oracle ran around and had those little penguins and said Oracle Linux, does that mean that Oracle was one of the developers on Linux and it was part of the free software thing? I mean, how did they get the name attached to Oracle? A couple years ago they ran around with free penguins, they were all on t-shirts and stuffed animals and the t-shirt said, I develop on Linux, shouldn't you, or something like that.
Yeah, I wasn't mapped for the entire advertising campaign. There may be a trademark issue, which we won't touch, but certainly when you talk about free software, anybody can jump on the bandwagon. Thus, for example, there's a company called Red Hat that takes Linux, which they can get copies of for free without infringing anybody's copyright, and they package it up nicely and they call it Red Hat Linux. And maybe they'll put something else in there and call it Red Hat Linux. It's a branding thing that anybody's able to take it up so long as those copyright notices end up proceeding along the way. Oh, that just left me a message, not worth trying anymore, so I left. Just me, the man behind the curtain. Yes.
For things that are functional, the way I'm thinking of code is less expressive and more functional, something that performs a job.
For stuff that is more functional, the deal in patent is a little bit different. The deal in patent is we want you to disclose the secret sauce. You in your patent statement say, this is how a better mousetrap works. And then anybody that does anything that pretty much resembles that mousetrap runs the risk of infringing your patent. And to say they haven't heard of you, and they close their eyes when they build their mousetrap, isn't going to avail much. Because before you set off to make a better mousetrap, of course what you'll do is pour through the hundreds of millions of pages of prior art in the U.S. Patent Trademark Office database, looking at different mousetraps and seeing what's already out there, and what licenses you'll have to obtain if you want to do anything like this. It's a completely different scheme designed to get people to disclose their secrets and get them out there so anybody can use them, but then have to license them. So you still get paid for it, but at least you know how the thing works. That's why Coca-Cola is not a patented thing, because to patent it, they have to put the recipe on file with the PTO, and they don't want to do that, so they keep it involved. A few people know how it works.
I don't have time around, and then you will say something about it later about the slogan by Starman that free Coke is about freedom, not about price.
Yes.
Because, I mean, what he basically says is that, okay, I can send it, I can sell you the copy of my program, and afterwards you have to follow it again. But isn't this special or longer? I mean, I can sell you the first copy, and then you can use whatever you want to do with them. I mean, isn't it just sheer rhetoric to say that this is open software and compared to closed software, which you can buy anyway? I mean, in both cases, you have to buy a copy of the software.
Well, he would say that he personally doesn't sell the software, which I don't think he does. He happily gives it away. But that it doesn't offend him, this is the kind of phraseology he used to it, does not morally offend me for somebody to want to sell their code, so long as, after they sell it once, they give along with it plus source code so people see how to change and make use of it, and in turn are giving that license so that if they want to, they can copy it for free. That's why he has no problem with Red Hat. Indeed, if you saw in his manifesto written in 93, he predicted the existence of something like Red Hat to come along, package up free software nicely to the masses, and oxymoronic as it may sound, sell free software to people.
I think he himself says that free software is not about not selling copies. And he himself said at some point, because he left his job, because he didn't want to work for the corporation, he should take his work away and allow him to share it with his fellow mates in computer programming, that he said at some point he had to sell copies. Which is okay, I mean, but this doesn't mean that he is against copyright and software programs.
No, in fact, he's
maybe there's some crucial link I'm missing here.
Yes. We'll jump to this in a second, but the quick answer is, Richard Stallman, I understand, to be against copyright in the sense that he thinks it should be abolished. He thinks there should be no such thing as copyright. But he is for copyright in the sense of, so long as there is copyright, he will happily use it as a legal construct in order to prevent his stuff from becoming further proprietized thanks to copyright. There is a certain tricky inversion, this kind of piece through strength, the way that you invoke copyright in the general public license for the purpose of preventing somebody from further proprietizing the code if they make modifications to it. But that, at least, is his idea behind it, so long as we live in a world of copyright. Let me just give you the last piece of this chart, and then we can start to figure out, once we're getting used to how this taxonomy works, and why we should care about it. So up here we have the network protocols. I was talking about there used to be this thing called Trumpet, and now it's part of the operating system, blah, blah, blah. Here's TCP/IP. TCP/IP, under my rubric of open versus closed, is about as open as it gets. TCP/IP is a protocol. It's a recipe for how you might choose to exchange data with somebody else far away and only a wire between you that also happens to be looking at the same recipe of TCP/IP. In that sense, it is literally a protocol. Think of a protocol as a sense of, we shake hands, that's a protocol. That means I'm not going to kill you. You shake somebody's hand, they shake your hand, and there's some old story, I'm sure apocryphal, about you do it with your sword hand. It's a way of showing you're not about to slice them as you pass them. Some kind of malarkey like that. But the fact is, it's a way of sending agreed upon signals back and forth to each other. Just as we were talking about simple transparency protocol before, and there just has to be agreement. First say it was to, and then from, and then to, that kind of thing. So TCP/IP is a protocol. We saw from the readings that it was created by the IETF, which Scott Ratner, without any apparent sense of irony, calls a non-membership membership organization. And the IETF, in turn, gives itself to the Internet Society, which is a real corporation, which then asserts copyright on them for the purpose of giving all the rights away to the public. So that anybody can freely copy these protocols, if you base something on TCP/IP, nobody can come chase you later and say you are infringing our copyright or you owe us a license fee because you chose to use it. And thus we have, in a typical classroom like this, a panoply of networked computers, with a non-functional network, but usually a functional network, for which the computers are running proprietary operating systems, relatively closed, but talking to each other using open protocols and open standards on a network. It didn't have to be that way. It could have been exactly opposite. I don't know how many of you remember Novell networks. It used to be, before TCP/IP got into favor among personal computer users, that if you wanted to hook your network and your computers together in a network, either for a remote comment submission system or to use a printer that was three doors down, you had to use Novell. Novell used proprietary standards. And Novell had this idea that someday their LAN, their local area network, would become a WAN, a wide area network, which is just a big network with Novell in the middle. And if you wanted to send an email from one computer on your LAN to another computer on another LAN, there would be Novell in the middle to collect a nickel, because it would be the one to license who could hook in or not to that network, because it would be in a position to license the availability of the protocols. But for some reason, Novell protocols didn't catch on so well, and TCP/IP did. Similarly, there was a time when we thought that AOL would take over the world, that America Online would just be the internet. And if you wanted to get onto the internet, the meaning of that would be you signed on to AOL. And to have an email address on the internet would simply be having an AOL screen name. And you wouldn't put @AOL.com because there would be nothing else about anything. All there would be, you know, John Smith and Hot Pants 15 and, you know, all these different names out there. And you'd send email back and forth, and you'd be hooking into AOL in the middle. And if AOL got big enough, it'd kind of be like AT&T. You know, you'd regulate it at some point. But that was going to be the future of a global network interconnecting all of us from one office building, house, and mobile phone to another. It didn't quite turn out that way either. We ended up with these so-called open standards. But it's an odd combination. Being able to actually, at least with the thought experiment, what if a given open standard is closed, what if a given closed one were more open, can be quite helpful in trying to predict which way the net is going to go.
Did you guys have a question or something?
Oh, yes. A reminder, we have a panel today. Perhaps we should call it. Well, at this stage, that actually makes sense, because we've got some of the taxonomy down. We've got, like, this working vocabulary. So I can show you a rabbit, and you can call a rabbit. I can show you a bear, and you can call a bear. So again, why should we care? So we have our panelists today, and we ask them, actually, to take on different roles that might be parties to some kind of dispute involving open and closed code. So here we have an open coder. Here we have a proprietary software component, a computer user, here we have a legislator, and a venture capitalist. All right, well, so let me start with the computer user. This computer user, can you tell us what any of this discussion has to do with anything? During the market for a new computer, do you care whether or not the software running on the computer, say the operating system, is open or closed?
As a basic computer user, I'd say probably not, and maybe one's closed because somebody's already done it all, made it easy for me to use. I'm not terribly interested in figuring out how it works, just wanting to work. And I don't need to change. So I'd probably prefer closed if it's functional.
And you wouldn't be just indifferent to actually actively want to close one?
Maybe more indifferent from looking at it from now, or open tends to be more difficult from non-open.
It's true. If you've ever, I don't know how many people have tried to ever run Linux or do something with it. Red Hat Linux is a little bit simpler. I'm going to actually risk Armageddon here and see if I can get one of these computers to work. Oh, yeah, here we are. Yeah, that is very great. Have you seen more pictures? I need a secure shell to get into the Eon box. I don't think they have such a complete new body or something. In other words, I'm entirely unprepared to show you a Linux window. What's that? Do you know Linux? I can just tell that somewhere? This has to be fast. The time's wasting here. Alright, I'm going to try to make over. Just to make over, buddy. He's the new bed. Alright, so Mako's going to get us into a Linux box, and the very complexity of doing this will give you some hint as to what it is to use a Linux box. So alright, I take your point. you say, as a general user of stuff, do you really care? Let me ask you a different question. If you're buying a can of soup at the store, do you care whether or not the ingredients are listed on the label?
Probably not for a can of soup. I don't know how much stuff is going to go in there. Maybe you might want to know if there's something that someone might be allergic to. But beyond that...
But as the typical soup eater, you're not allergic to anything.
No.
And you can care less what's on the label. So, as a typical soup eater, would you mind if the labeling regulations of the United States were simply repealed? And it were left up to the manufacturer of cans of soup to decide whether or not to say what's inside?
I think it'd be some, apparently not on my individual level when I go to the store, but at a sort of more general level, that in the end, the corporations or the food manufacturers can take advantage of that and start decreasing the quality of the ingredients, putting stuff in that, you know, might be harmful, and just generally kind of making an individual decision. So, at just a single person level, it may not make that big a difference, but it could have a greater effect.
So let me ask the legislator. As a legislator, do you think it matters very much whether we label our soup cans?
I think it does. I think for the purposes, if you think the worst case scenario would be something that a company would know no longer had to label what the ingredients were, and felt free to put in lower qualities and that's even harmful for you. It was just without that regulatory aspect of forcing to list what exactly is in it, presuming that they did actually put those things in on the list of them, they would feel free to kind of have carte blanche with what they would put in, but it might be dangerous to consumers as a whole. It would be more kind of a broader base of decisions, would be my concern.
I wouldn't say what kind of beef goes into the soup, right? It just says beef and beef byproducts.
Right. But I mean, for all I knew, if they took the labeling away, they could put in rat or something. remotely about it. It tastes like chicken, so they're going to put it in there. Vegetarians would be mad.
Vegetarians would be mad? You would just say the market will take care of that, right? There'll be a special niche market for vegetarians, and they'll just pay a slight premium for the listing of ingredients on the side of the soup. And that'll do it, right?
Well, beyond specific preferences in that regard, I think most people, whether they were allergic to certain things or just wanted to have more purity in what they ate, would be willing to pay a slightly higher premium or just would require regulation to the extent that they would be able to see what was in it. They wouldn't want to take that chance.
So let me ask our proprietary software component. Do you have any trouble with the freedom to not disclose the ingredients of soup?
No, because I can always disclose the ingredients of my soup and charge my customers a slightly higher price for that knowledge.
So you accept then that basically you want to sell unlabeled software to people. They have no idea what goes inside, and if they try to find out, you're prepared to go after them.
I'm not sure I follow. I would be selling, as a proprietary software proponent, I would be selling the software that I own, or at least the software that I have, the open software that I have, stood behind with the warranty of merchantability and better manuals.
Right, it won't tell you what's inside, it just assure you it won't kill you.
Right. That's why I suppose I could make the sort of ingredients or the source code available, but then not freely license it. Just because people know what it is doesn't mean I've sort of licensed it along the new public license model.
That's true. You can make your source code available, but then tell people they're not supposed to do anything with it. As a proprietary software component,
well, that's what book publishers do. You know, the source code is available for a book, but if you copy my book, I can go after you.
That's true. The books are your typical book. The source code, which is, say, the English or other language meant to communicate one thing with another, is right there. And we don't compile language into brain code that just gets loaded and flatted.
Right, and the sort of copyright regime has worked fine for books. If people want to create an open software movement, they're very well free to do so, and I can still sort of feed on my corner of the market, and they can take over their corner of the market and
everyone will be happy.
So let me ask our open coder. Why shouldn't it just be, if you want to be Richard Stallman and give away your stuff, fine. And if you want to be Microsoft, we should be Microsoft, right? Like, what's the problem with that?
Well, I think what comes down to is freedom. And Richard Stallman's right when he talks about liberated software and shackled software. I think that you can take that a little bit further than that. Users of liberated software are slightly freer. Users of shackled software aren't necessarily less free, but they could be in certain circumstances. And that they're dragged down by lesser efficiency in creating it, lesser knowledge of how to use it, lesser personal efficacy in being able to actually manipulate the programs that they use in their day-to-day life. And they're just stuck, and get stuck in a holding pattern with a company that doesn't want to help them. It's sort of problems you have to wait for the next
Right. So talk directly to the computer user behind you and tell her why she's making a grave mistake by just getting proprietary
computer user. Have you ever called a software company that would not be very helpful to you?
Yes.
Have you ever tried logging into, say, a chat room on Debian Linux and asked a question for some help in fixing something?
Yes,
they can't
use Linux
to
start.
Good response.
We're at direct examination. Right, my question and answer would be strictly.
How many answer
the question is that? So, have you made a persuasive case to her? You told her she's not going to get any help from Microsoft, at least not $1.99 a minute or less, if she's having trouble. And nobody else can help her either because nobody else knows how this stuff works. On the other hand, you tell there's plenty of help available for open code, but she doesn't know how to use it anyway.
She's right in the current system. You sort of have to have a good head start before you're going to be able to get much help. But, we're working on that. And I think part of that is there aren't enough, because of the power of proprietary software, still there aren't enough incentives for open coders and open coding companies like Red Hat to be out there. The more incentive there is for them, and the more sort of that idea catches on, the more they are going to be working on it. Red Hat is going to eventually be trying to make its money by making the software as easy to use as possible, making it accessible and available, and having really good help. That's about the only thing they can sell as a service, because they're not selling code.
Gotcha. I think Mako has an example of source code.
The one on top is source code, and that one right there is object code.
It's the
exact same program. Program.
And that's the object code.
I've built that source code, and that's what it comes down with. That is almost readable.
Okay. And do you have an example of software that was released open source that has since been modified by somebody that got it and knew better than, say, the computer user what to do with it?
That piece of software right there is a piece of software that I took and I repackaged.
And what does it do?
It's most. It's actually the program that we're using to do the programs.
Hey, this program has a lot of recursive stuff. It's the program we're using to do the program.
It lets you look at a file in pure text, be it source or be it.
And what feature did you add to it?
I added it so that it's much more easy to install and makes it so that you just grab an object and click on update on that.
And what motivated you to do this?
I was sick of going out and updating it and having to go through this long process.
You have what Eric Raymond calls that itch of your own, and you fixed your itch, and then you decided to share it with the world at large. Has anybody paid you for this? Are you hoping somebody might give you a
for it.
Dollar bill or an envelope?
Right? I don't know.
So what motivated you to share?
The fact that, I put this in a pool with another 5,000 application, which I use. I package two of them. I use probably a thousand.
So this is some kind of communist thing. Like, you're going to get some stuff in, and they're going to get some stuff in. And it's kind of like you tell them file sharing or something. Now you'll share your tunes, they'll share theirs.
And you all get a better money.
So now, to the trained ear of most of the proto lawyers in the room, this sounds like insanity, right? This sounds like this cannot be. And indeed, the same economists that write papers like The Problem of Black Men. When they say the problem of blackmail, they don't mean how do we stop blackmail. They mean how can we understand blackmail as a problem, since all it is the offering of true information about someone else, and more information is good, and if you want to pay us, yada, yada, yada. So those people who write about the problem of blackmail also are scratching their heads trying to figure out what makes irrational people like Mako tick, and how many of them are among us gumming up theoretical assumptions about the way markets work? And it turns out that there are a number of MAKOs out there. There are enough MAKOs to produce TCP/IP. These are these engineers who get together for meetings. They don't get paid. You don't know their names. They just do it for the kinds of reasons MAKO says. And that has produced the internet, the core backbone internet protocols that we use day in and day out to transfer all sorts of stuff, including money, from one country to another. Let me ask our venture capitalists something. There's a new software venture. Each of these guys, Mr. Proprietary Software Proponent and Mr. Open Coder, are working on a piece of software to do the same thing. It's not just Mostest, it's called Mostest. And it's a great way of doing text files with talking ducks and stuff like that. And this guy wants to release Mostest as a proprietary piece of code. You just sell it like pancakes, one to the customer, and that's how much it costs. He says he's going to make it open source, but he'll be willing to, you know, sell individual copies, perhaps, just so long as people who get the copies can freely pass them along. Which are you more likely to invest in?
Well, I mean, the way you phrase it depends if they're exactly the same product. Is that what you're
saying? I don't know. They have the same goal in mind, but like any venture capitalist, interviewing people in person, you have no idea if what they're proposing even exists.
Well, I probably tend to shift towards the proprietary software, just because, I mean, if I'm going to put money into a venture, I need to make sure that it's constrained in some ways. It's not just going to go free to most people. And, you know, this is money. This isn't, I'm doing it for the public. I want to make money on my investment. So I would tend to, if I thought maybe that the open source coder had a better product or had a better idea, but sort of was enthralled by this idea of just making it free for the sake of it, I might try to constrain it here and there on some contracts or convince them to just make it proprietary.
You give them a pile of money and then you say you can proprietize it later.
And I would also argue that his ultimate goal of more people enjoying it, the open source for people actually being able to use it, requires that it's mass distributed and requires that we have some legal restrictions on it, and it would be better for, if he wants more people to use it, if he doesn't want a very smallish community to just use it, it would be better if he made it private.
So what do you say,
Carter?
Well, I think first thing I would say is we need to make sure we keep the distinction clear between free software and open code. Free isn't money, and free isn't, you know, free code. Just because I'm an open coder doesn't mean I'm going to give everything away for free that I write. If I'm starting a company and I'm trying to get venture capital, I'm probably going to sell something. I might sell some finished product the way sort of Red Hat, again, you know, you can buy Red Hat off of a shelf in a Best Buy, or you can download it for free.
Or you might sell support.
Exactly. We're certainly going to still be making money. And I think that we actually have incentive to. I think we'll be eventually coming out with a better product because we're going to have millions of people working on it, the users who deal with it every day working on it. And in addition to that, you know, we can't capture a market with sort of incompatibility. We can't get a certain market and then hold it, you know, with sort of incompatibility with software, other software, and all kinds of issues and things that proprietary software holders can actually do. We have more incentive to actually keep up with the times, constantly update, give good service, create the best software possible, because that's the only thing that we can sell is good, is really good software, you know, the most usable thing, the best service. We can't sort of get some sort of proprietary system in place that people are stuck with.
Gotcha. Are there questions for our panelists? Something that somebody wants to ask our panelists? Yes, in the back, but I'll make the card if I can see.
My question is for the open coder. If you want everyone to be another open coder so that there are these millions of ants building the cathedral, who's going to pay them for their time?
I forgot his name.
Whose name?
No. Jason. Did you get paid for your time?
No.
Okay.
Man,
so you're going to have an army of slaves.
I think part of the answer is that you've got a lot of volunteers. You've got a lot of people who are really interested in this stuff, and a lot of people who have incentives to make small tweaks on their own time just to make things better for themselves and then to share them.
But what about the billions of people who will ultimately use computers and don't know anything about coding?
Right, like I
sort of been trying to emphasize. Ultimately, we want to get a really useful product that not everybody's going to know how to, not everybody who uses it is going to have to know, you know, how to lift up the hood and tinker with it. I think, you know, the goal eventually is to have a great, you know, highly usable, highly user-friendly product. You know, by nature of the fact that the only thing we have to sell is making it usable, providing good service, and there'll be tons of people working on it, millions of people working on it, constantly updating to make it more and more usable.
And how are they going to feed themselves while they're doing all this to make it better for you who is going to profit by selling it to me who doesn't know how to code?
Well, first of all, we've got, you know, we're going to have a company and we'll have some actual professional coders on staff that actually get paid a salary, but a lot of these people are, you know, they have day jobs and they're just going to do little bits at a time as it comes up and as sort of a hobby. It's happening as we speak. It might sound incomprehensible, but it's actually happening. Tons and tons of software that's currently out there to help.
Yeah, good question.
I just want to add on the side of the home user, the reason to use open code is not just to get better service and not to pay much for service. It's really freedom. It has two aspects. One is first that you know what you're having on your computer, to know what you're putting inside your house when you're installing the computer. There has been writing about, for example, Microsoft applications like Word or Excel that do things that the home user don't know, like sending their private information to Microsoft Center.
So let's just stop right there for a second. He's invoking this thing called GUIDs. How many of you have not heard of GUIDs? All right, you all have a GUID assigned to you. You just don't know it. It turns out there's a guy named Richard Smith who bills himself as a security consultant. He actually lives in Boston. And what he seems to do for a living, although it's unclear how he's paid for this, is he discovers interesting things inside software that the media would be surprised to know about, and by extension you, if only it brought to their attention. So he found these things called GUIDs inside the Microsoft Office suite. And a GUID was a generic user identification code that was unique to that particular implementation of a particular program. So I run Microsoft Office on my machine, I'll have a GUID that is not like anybody else's GUID, no matter how many copies of Microsoft Office they're running. And at this point, the GUID gets tacked on to my documents as I make them. So if I were to make an anonymous document that I thought was anonymous, and it just says, I am coming to kill you, and then I attach it to an email, and I send it through an anonymous rerouter so that my email lands on somebody's desk, and I believe that I've exercised my freedom to speak anonymously, it turns out that the GUID inside could be used to compare back to my original copy of Microsoft Office and find out that, in fact, I was the author of that document. Indeed, moments after he discovered the existence of the GUID, something that Microsoft had failed to mention in its user documentation, the Melissa virus was released. This is a virus that comes as part of a Word document, and in essence, the virus said, I am going to erase your hard drive, and that's what it did if you double-clicked on it in the wrong fashion. And he was able to find the guy that did the virus because the GUID was inside the file. So an oddly happy ending to what you thought was a sad story about proprietary code containing within it features you don't know about and aren't alerted to. And thus, as you say, there's probably, yes, Eric.
I just want to raise a few more of these paranoid type ideas. Wasn't there a complaint by the French, generally, or was complaint?
We'll cover that later.
That some Microsoft products were working with the U.S. government who had a program to gather commercial information, and now the French are considered spying, and Microsoft products enable doing that by being embedded in various software to report back to the CIA. And also, weren't the Chinese concerned, are concerned, that if they buy, if they run their military on Microsoft products, they'll have trouble targeting us with our ICBMs?
Yes, the Chinese have said they are somewhat concerned about this and have turned to GNU Linux another story with an oddly unhappy ending. Now they can tune their ICBMs to us without fear, because Windows will not intervene when Minesweepers play for real and do fine. So, yes, there has indeed been a claim that is akin. I mean, these are all subsets of the claim about shouldn't you know what you're eating. It's analogous to this kind of powerful food metaphor. I want to know how many people are thinking that you must disclose the software. This is a law that does not exist yet, but they would vote for such a law that says you must disclose the source code with any object code that you introduce into the stream of commerce. How many people are in favor of that proposition and vote for it today? Okay, among those of you voting against, how many people are against such a proposition? Okay, you're against it, at least willing to admit so. Keep your hand up. And now keep your hand up if you are in favor of the labeling rules for cans of soup. All right, so somebody who has kept the hand up, you, sir, how do you explain this apparent inconsistency in your voting?
Well, I mean, when you're talking about a can of soup, you're talking about maybe 10, 20, or 30 ingredients, and the kind of bad effects of a surprising ingredient like arsenic or something would be kind of more obvious. When you're talking about software, you might be talking about, you know, 100 million lines of code.
So this is an impracticability objection, or is it they won't understand it anyway?
They won't understand it anyway.
But Richard Smith will understand it, and he can tell the rest of us.
But I think if you're the government, you're requiring a certain kind of, you know, the market to do something. Your interest shouldn't be Richard Smith; it should be the average computer user. And it's quite possible that by forcing proprietary coders to reveal their code, that you might put them in a market disadvantage that will ultimately harm computer users and make either the software more expensive.
A market disadvantage vis-a-vis who?
Vis-a-vis their competition.
But their competition has to disclose too, right?
But I think there's a value to having the code
Yes, this is where Richard Stallman would say those are runners running the race, and they should be allowed to beat each other up and trip each other on the way to the finish line. At least, again, that's what Richard Stallman would say. Yes,
so the difference is by listing the ingredients in a can of soup, I can't instantly email someone a can of soup, you know, expenselessly. I mean, the ingredients allow you to do a certain thing, it allows you to sort of recreate the soup. But by making open source, I can have a very easy way to copy the code, change the code, which there is no sort of analog in soup.
Yes.
What you're paying for partly in soup, even if they list ingredients, is the fact that they packaged it so nicely in the can, which is not true of this sort of ingredient list in the form of code.
So here's how Richard Stallman would reply. Richard Stallman would say, what if, in fact, all you needed to generate a can of soup was the recipe? If that were the case, would you actually be in favor of a legal regime that criminalized those who make cans of soup out of recipes? Are you just thinking about it, or are you...
I would change the soup labeling laws at that point. I think that then you would have sort of a market-driven force where you let those companies exist, and if they had the reputation and goodwill to be able to make soup without listing their ingredients,
right,
then they survive, and those that prefer to make the ingredients right available, they can survive too.
Right. Now, Richard Stallman would say he could imagine some kind of society in which it would be illegal to manufacture food from recipes if all it took was a press of the button, and people could actually starve, be food deprived, for the purpose of allowing those who create the recipes to maximize their profit from them so that they have incentive to create the recipes to begin with. But again, Stallman would say, what kind of society would that be? Now, of course, all of this relies on a connection between soup and software that is one that has to be built. But at least it shows you a certain path that leads towards some relevance. And in the couple minutes we have left, let me just try to give you my own best thoughts again on why we should care about this. In sessions of this sort, we've talked about open source, I've taught open source a number of times now. This is one of the harder sessions, because it's a little bit of technical going, You'll find this actually useful in tomorrow's trusted system debate, the Microsoft case, we'll discuss it later. But you still may be struggling with, you know, what this all has to do with anything. Let me give you at least a summary of some of the things we've seen. We've had Richard M. Stallman's answer, that's RMS. And Richard M. Stallman's answer, as powerfully as I can put it, is the soup answer. It says, this is the product of your labors. There is this blessed fact about software. And the blessed fact is it is non-rivalrous as a good. I can give it to you without myself losing it. And to be able to do that is a gift. It's a magic feature of the world. And to suddenly impose a legal regime upon it to try to make it like a chair, a piece of property that I can manufacture at zero cost but still control the distribution as carefully as I can control a rivalrous object like a chair. Excuse me. With chair. He says that is just unethical. It's immoral. Law shouldn't reflect that. Now, Stallman is anything but mainstream. He is out there. He also, talk about medium and message, his medium resembles his message. He lives an ascetic life. He is the best example of the kind of programmer he thinks should exist that there is out there. There may not be a whole lot like him to the core, but there are a lot of Makos out there who at least at one point in their young lives are thinking, you know, this is kind of fun. And only later, when they start talking to Mr. BC or somebody else, they say, you know, who needs this? I can go to the Microsoft campus, Building 11, and make a lot of money. So Stallman's answer is we should care about open code because we don't even realize it, but we are trapped in the matrix. And we've got to get out. That's the kind of answer he's giving. I don't know why people are kissing him. But that's his kind of answer. It's like a whole paradigm shifting sort of answer. And I think it's a worthy thing to be exposed to, whether you agree with it or not. Eric Raymond, you read some of the Cathedral and the Bazaar. I don't know how farcical it was. Eric Raymond's answer is a lot more code-tied. Eric Raymond says, forget the communist. He's crazy. We're not, you know, we like him, but we're not relying on his arguments. Instead, Eric Raymond makes arguments about what is simply a more effective means of coding. The Cathedral or the Bazaar. And Raymond wants to make the best case that he can for a mode of software engineering that is counterintuitive as it may seem to somebody who has not written software but does have a doctorate in economics. It's something that has produced results in the past and properly encouraged and subsidized could produce results in the future. And that indeed, if we're thinking about what is the more secure system, one on closed code, for which you don't know how much testing has gone into it, you make a bug report, you have no idea if anybody looks at it, you don't know if the changes get made, versus one that is open, you know exactly every single line of code, and if you are something other than the average computer user, you can work with that code. He says it's the latter code that is the more secure, even though it has the fewest secrets within. Now there's a third answer that I don't know if it's reflected on this, let me see, it's not. And that's Lessig's answer. Lessig's answer to why we should care about this open versus closed debate, so much so that they'd be worthy of a policy intervention rather than just letting the market sort out what becomes open and what becomes closed. His answer is, if what you care about is regulability, if for some reason you believe that the internet should have a certain degree of anarchy associated with it, you like that, you think that's good, you're Barlow. He says, if the pieces of the internet, those pieces, if they comprise closed code, they are much more readily changeable and undone. To the extent that the government of the United States can strong-arm Microsoft into putting in a feature or taking out a certain feature of their code, all you gotta do is get Microsoft to buckle, and soon every single Microsoft user is subject to it. He says that makes for much more regulability of the net than an internet in which the minute a piece of software comes out, derivative works can be made, alternatives can pop up, and you can have all sorts of variations in regimes on the internet come about. He says that is much less regulable, and as a result, the kind of internet we'll live with tomorrow, one of great control or one of not very much control, for better or worse, could itself hinge on the relative predominance of open versus closed code. And if there's a fourth reason I can pick up, you can call this my reason, It has to do with competition. Oftentimes you might say, let's just let those markets sort it out. Let there be open code, let there be closed code, and we'll just see what people buy. It's truly more reliable their agreement, the market will bear that out. There may be issues, however, that aren't exactly the chart that was there, such that if you control a big enough chunk of internet protocol or operating system, you may be in a position, if you have to prioritize, to control a whole lot else. And that creates a significant problem. That problem, if we're talking market terms, you find there's market failure of some sort. There are tools to deal with it. Antitrust, for example, that's why we have a Microsoft case. But antitrust may not be the best tool in the toolbox, and tweaking some of the ground rules about open versus closed may in the long run prove a better way to avoid the problems rather than waiting for them to pop up and hoping that antitrust can solve them. With that, I think we are at time. Are there any announcements to make before we break? Tomorrow we're going to talk about trusted systems. We're going to talk about a whole new generation of code that may well change the way the content gets protected through technology. On the net, hopefully we'll have a tech person then, and we'll see you then. Yes?
Just one announcement for anybody who's still working on coming up with what you would like to do your paper on. There are a couple of good opportunities coming up if you're willing to do your paper in a slightly more accelerated fashion. One is the ICANN-LA Pressing Issues 2 conference that we're going to be doing in LA, where we're looking at a bunch of the issues that are coming up next year for ICANN, like new top-level domains, review of the UDRP, membership structure, and the briefing book essays for that. And another one is that we're going to be doing a follow-up to last year's Signal and Noise MP3 conference, and there's going to need to be a briefing book for that also that is going to deal with the new issues for the MP3 conference. So consider those if you are interested, and if you particularly want to do any of them, please get in touch with me.
One last thing, just for planning purposes. Raise your hand if you think you're going to attend the Valenti Lessig debate next Sunday. Excellent. This is really going to be fun. How many of you think you're going to attend the lunchtime food court? Okay. And how many of the evening ICANN candidates? Okay. Thanks very much.